Welcome to the RSP Cast. I'm Matt Waldman, author of the Rookie Scouting Portfolio. I'm an NFL outsider, but my evaluation of skill prospects has earned the attention of NFL insiders. For the next half hour, I'll share my process, analysis, and stories of the game within the game. Welcome to episode 5. We're going to begin. I want you to imagine playing a little half-court basketball. And I think anyone who's played enough basketball outside in a park or at the gym, and you've seen half-court games where some dude who's, 15 to 25 years older than everybody else, you get a chance to play a pickup game with him, and he's usually fatter, slower, stiffer, grayer, and balder than everybody on the court. But he understands the passing lanes. He knows how to pick and roll. He understands leverage. Every movement that he makes is efficient. It's practiced. And it's often unstoppable. And he can wear people out who are half his age because of those skills. And to me, this is how I would characterize old man game. And it's a phrase that my buddy Eric Stoner, who used to write for the Rookie Scouting Portfolio site, often used when he was characterizing players who exhibit strong enough conceptual and technical skill that they can beat younger players who have a significant athletic edge. Guy who I would say most recently had the best old man game I saw was a former basketball player, and that was Tony Gonzalez, the former Chief and Atlanta Falcon. He had old man game at the point that at 37, he still caught 82 passes for 847 yards and 8 touchdowns, finishing his career with a season that was top 6 in production at his position in 2013. And the year prior, he was 36 and had 93 catches, 930 yards, and he also had 8 scores in that one. That was good enough for third among tight ends. And this wasn't a far cry from his production 10 years prior when he led tight ends with 71 catches for 916 yards and 10 scores. And when he was even 4 years into the league, it wasn't that much of a drop off compared to what he did later in his career. He had 1,200 yards on 93 catches. Maybe his yards per average was a couple of yards higher per catch. And maybe that dropped some because he didn't have the skill anymore to stretch the seam. He didn't have that speed. But he made up for it with knowledge and technique, and he still had enough athletic ability to thrive. But see, in the age of fantasy football, with the upswing that's about to come in a massive level with sports betting, and the fact that sports data often encourages the masses to play the percentages, I think fans are encouraged to tread pretty far from aging players. They're learning how to spot and avoid egregious mistakes that helps them become smarter and more efficient with what they do. And I think fantasy owners and sports bettors make safer decisions trying to avoid the egregious mistakes. That way it helps them lead to at least what they would call probably a satisfactory conclusion. Over the course of several bets, they're going to win money. And I think that this mindset echoes a lot of corporate thinking. Identify the easy errors, spot that low-hanging fruit, fix those things so that the worker, the team, the organization, they develop greater efficiency, they perform to higher standard of quality, and it increases their productivity. And this is true up to a point. Conventional methods, they eliminate problems. But the structures that are created with conventional methods can also inhibit a worker or a team or an organization from risks that often lead to growth. And when you're in a competitive endeavor, a highly competitive environment, once a strategy becomes conventional, it often becomes dangerous. Because everyone's taken the same path in the attempt to reach the same destination where there's only going to be one winner. So for me, I think it's important to emphasize the fact that we're going to see how this relates back to football, but the worker, the team, the organization that takes a different path, they often reach that destination sooner, or they create a situation where the innovation changes the destination and the reward comes to them rather than trying to race other people to a location. And they end up having the reward come to them, and that leaves the competition traveling to a location that's no longer, you know, that's no longer fertile ground. So whether you label it risk-friendly or contrarian, entrepreneurial or innovative thinking, people who engage in these approaches understand the rules, but they seek the potential exceptions that can create big advantages in ultra-competitive environments. And you don't have to completely eschew convention to adopt risk-friendly paths. A lot of successful organizations have well-funded and supportive research and development divisions, and they encourage this kind of innovative thinking while still having conventional methods in terms of what they're doing operationally until they've created something innovative that they can put a process around that's different from what everybody else does, and then they can achieve that strong success. And then they're continuing to innovate and have a place where they can have space to be creative and risk-friendly and entrepreneurial. But, you know, in the football media this summer, you know, I'm hearing the term washed a lot. You know, it's the lamentation that teams are giving washed up players an opportunity to play ahead of younger, more athletic players, or at least the possible threat of that. You know, and it's coming from analysts that I respect in the community. So when this happens, I think it's often a great signal to explore the opposing point of view. Because even if I discover that I ultimately agree with these analysts who are saying, you know, that Frank Gore or Jordy Nelson or Marshawn Lynch are washed up, I think it's a worthwhile exercise. And I did this last year with Adrian Peterson. And here's the thing, you know, when you talk about a guy like Adrian Peterson last year, I think that most people would just look at the box score, or they, if they're fantasy owners, they'd look at fantasy points and they'd say, well, that Adrian Peterson didn't prove anything. He's, you know, he's not even with a team right now, and he didn't play all that great overall. And they'd be right. And they'd be right to say that, you know, his age is a reason that he's no longer in the league. But see, here's the thing. I think a lot of people mistake age as an issue when really the issue is that age creates an issue with economics. The minimum that that the league has to pay a player with a certain number of years of tenure and proven production, and what that player is going to want to demand out of that, whether it's realistic or not. And so it's more about the financial issue along with the competition. And there's a number of different viable running backs out there who are younger, who will cost less, and who offer lower risk with a higher reward because they can grow with the team if they do work out. But people confuse that with Adrian Peterson's washed up. And then to add to that equation, they looked at things like, well, Adrian Peterson didn't perform well with Minnesota 2 years ago. He didn't perform, you know, he didn't look as fast. And there's two kinds of things with that. And one of the things that I looked at footballguys.com last year was, can Adrian Peterson be productive? And it wasn't as much about his ability as you'd think. It's often about philosophy and surrounding talent. And when you look at, you know, I just looked at a series of numbers, you know, for simplicity's sake, you know, I looked at, you know, a series of his carries in multiple games. And there were a number of times where in one game he had 14 positive runs that were at least 4 yards or more, and 14 negative runs. In another week, he had 10 positive and 10 negative. In a week after that, he had 6 positive and 12 negative. There was a game he had 3 positive and 17 negative. You know, you're seeing these types of at least 50-50 or even like way beyond more negative than positive. But, you know, when I looked at those outcomes where there was often equal positive to negative or more negative to than positive, there were games like in, you know, this was from 2015, where Peterson had a 29 carry for 134 yard game, a 20 carry, 126 yard, 2 touchdown performance against the Chargers the week after that. You know, and again, these were even to positive to negative. There was a 16 carry, 81 yard touchdown, 1 touchdown performance against the Broncos where he had twice as many negative yardage as positive. There was a 19 for 98 with 3 touchdowns against Detroit where he only had you know, three positive runs to 17 negative. And, you know, if you're looking at yards per carry or, you know, yards on that particular part, and that's not even a great context. So, you know, when you look at this, what you're seeing here is that sometimes committing to the run is a pretty ugly process. And I know that the running game is coming under attack from a lot of fantasy analysts and a lot of data analysts in the football community. And certainly, you know, I'm not arguing with the fact that you can be more efficient with how you run, that you can be better at knowing what down and distances are best for run versus pass. You got to be smarter about that. And if you can identify the low hanging fruit to be more efficient, have better quality plays drawn up and be more productive, you're doing the right thing there. But at the same time, there are times where you have to understand sometimes the context and how things are played out in terms of on the field. And sometimes you can see where execution is great with the 7 to 8 or 9 players who are setting up the running play. And then there can be a bad decision from the running back that ruins it, and where the box may be stacked, you know, at the line of scrimmage. And if that running back hits the right hole, he has a one-on-one with a deep safety. I was just having this conversation on Twitter with Michael Kist, the Eagles podcaster, who's been profiling Derrick Henry on Twitter a good bit. And we've been having some fun conversations looking at the film there. And I think, you know, one of his points was, well, listen, you know, it's 7 to 8 players have to execute at an excellent level to do this. There's kind of hubris to say that they can continue doing this against stacked boxes when, you know, it takes that much excellent effort from everybody. But, you know, the counter argument is that you can look at the passing game and say you're relying on only, you know, a certain, you may be relying on fewer individuals, or you could argue that you're relying on the same number and it still requires strong execution on a level that is, you know, just as important. But the point of the matter is that these are professionals, and there are teams that are very good at being able to execute the run. And if you put it against the right types of defenses, whether it's a stack box and you have a, you know, you have a runner who understands how to make the right reads, then that can still work out. And that can still create advantages for you, because teams are going to have to cheat even more when you're successful against them when they do stack the box. But, you know, that's an ongoing type of conversation. It's just one of those things that you have to understand that there is a macro effect of physical plays that aren't often individually impacted or individually impactful for a significant portion of the game. Now, again, efficiency is important, but the more an offensive line can attack a defense, the more energy it costs a defense to thwart it. If the defense is, you know, more nickel based and you're able to wear down players who, you know, who are more geared towards the pass, you can have some advantages as the game wears on. Certainly we saw that with the Jacksonville Jaguars against the Pittsburgh Steelers earlier in the season last year with Leonard Fournette. And I broke that down as well at Football Guys, showing how they really wore down the Pittsburgh defense in terms of mentally and physically and conceptually, in terms of how the cumulative effect of running certain types of plays forced the defense to cheat, the Steelers defense to start to anticipate runs, and then were and stacked the box, but they anticipated the wrong types of runs, or they got impatient with how they played that run play, and that allowed Leonard Fournette to start breaking bigger games. So it's one of those things that when you look at a guy like Adrian Peterson and you look at his box score, it could be somewhat deceptive. And the problem is that as the game changes in terms of trends, when you look at Peterson's style of play, he played in an I formation. And as a result of that, you know, with a fullback behind the eye, you know, and not working from spread, that was his best thing, was being able to play from the eye. And a lot of teams don't do that anymore, because It's become more of a passing league. It's become a league where 60% of the play calls that are made come from alignments that are 11 personnel, which is single back with three receivers and a tight end. And often those alignments are with a running back and shotgun. And that wasn't Adrian Peterson's strength. But at the same time, if you put him on a team, as I theorized last year, with an I formation backfield, with a quarterback who works under center, and you have a good offensive line that can block, you can get good results. And when those three things came into play with Peterson in Arizona, when the line finally got healthy after a couple of injuries early in the season, Peterson got traded from the Saints and he moved over there. He had a couple of decent games. And you could see, in fact, a couple of strong games, and you could still see that he had the quickness to hit the hole. He still had the footwork to manipulate the defense and set up his blocking schemes, and certainly still had the conceptual skill to follow those blocks and set them up so that he could create yardage. And the only thing that was missing from his game was top end speed. And I think oftentimes we conflate, a player's loss of top end speed with a complete loss of the physical skills to play the game. And that's incorrect. But the problem is that when you hear analysis about a player being washed or washed up, is that it's easy to just be right in, or try to strive to be right about who's going to succeed or not when the actual process isn't truthful. And I think that, it's not that they're intentionally trying to be misleading. I'm not saying that at all. I'm just saying that it's easy to play the odds and say he's old, so therefore he's not going to be good anymore. When the truth of the matter is he's old, he's still good enough to play, but financial factors in terms of, longevity, opportunity to really, use that player long term, it doesn't make sense to acquire that player unless you think that you're in a situation where your starter gets hurt and you need someone who's proven and you're in a position to win now. And the Cardinals thought they were in position to win now until it became clear that there were too many injuries that happened after they acquired Peterson to be able to compete for a playoff position. So the truth to me, and I think the truth that really is that shows up on the field, is that Adrian Peterson can still play. Is he 2,000 yard Adrian Peterson? Absolutely not, because he's not going to. You could see that he didn't have the speed to break runs beyond the 15 to 25, 30 yard mark. He wasn't going to turn those 10 yard gains that he got through the line of scrimmage into 50, 60 yard gains like he did in his peak years. But he could still get those 8 to 12 to 15 to 20 yard plays, and he could turn potential losses into 4 and 6 yard gains with a healthy offensive line. And when you remember Adrian Peterson in 2016 with the Minnesota Vikings, you also have to remember the fact that his offensive line was decimated. I mean, they couldn't protect the passer. They couldn't run block. Last year, that line was healthy, and it was one of the best offensive lines in football. It was the first time it was healthy in 2 years. So, again, sometimes we also conflate what the supporting staff's issues are with saying that the player, that the individual who depends on that support staff is now suddenly washed up. And we can see oftentimes that there's a bias where we want to look at the disaster with the supporting staff and the individual and decide, and we have this ability, we have this tendency to mistakenly want to see or confirm to our own minds that the player has lost a step or has significantly in decline physically. And I think that Adrian Peterson proved last year that he still had it there. And I think there are other players like that we're going to see pretty soon. I mean, Jordy Nelson is a player I just profiled recently, and Marshawn Lynch are two guys who I think a lot of people say have lost a step. But when you look at when you look at their production last year, when they were used in a way, with good supporting staff, Aaron Rodgers being healthy the first 6 weeks, Jordy Nelson was among the league leaders in catches, yards, and touchdowns during the first 6 weeks. After that, Well, Brent Hundley couldn't make more than one read without having to deal with pressure because of the offensive line. And Aaron Rodgers is a more accomplished technician and strategic quarterback who oftentimes makes better pre-snap reads. And his skills at movement and finding second and third reads and experience in this offense helps him kind of counteract some of the woes of the offensive line that Brent Hundley couldn't. And so Hundley was spending more times on his first reads or trying to figure out a way to avoid pressure after that. And that meant Davante Adams, and he had a better rapport. And then so, you know, there's some rationale there when you look at it. I think we're going to see a guy like Jordy Nelson show that he still has a lot left at age 31. Marshawn Lynch was, you know, a top 12 running back in terms of production down the stretch last year, even though the number of carries that he got was significantly smaller than a lot of the top backs in the league because the Raiders didn't use him in the way that we're going to see a guy like John Gruden use him, because now we're seeing Gruden at a fullback who's more of a blocker in Keith Smith, and they got rid of Jamize Olawale, who is more of a runner and receiver at that position. So they're going to, and they plan on using the fullback more. They added Doug Martin to the equation, which also gives them more continuity instead of Marshawn Lynch and then a couple of scat backs and Jalen Richard and DeAndre Washington playing behind them, which shows you Jack Del Rio wasn't looking to run as much. He wasn't committing to it as a way of being able to really move the ball unless they were in an advantageous situation to run. John Gruden is now trying to form a game plan where he can be that contrarian, where he's going to try and run more against teams that are playing 50-60% nickel in terms of the number of snaps that's their base defense. And that's most of the league now. And they were that way since around 2012, 2013. And we saw that with San Francisco, you know, being able to run against them and become, you know, major contenders with their run game with Frank Gore and, you know, being able to run from power sets. The Ravens did it in 2012. The 49ers did it in 2012. They were both Super Bowl teams. 49ers were, you know, in the thick of it, either at the conference championship for the next few years in 2013 and 14, and with the Seattle Seahawks, who also ran the ball really well with Marshawn Lynch. So it can happen, and it's happened recently. And so if you have a good offensive line, the Raiders have that, you can see how, you know, even an older player can at the running back position who still has the quickness, the vision, the understanding of blocking schemes can still be effective and used enough in a positive way that it can form a winning game plan. And it goes against, you know, it's something that plays that contrarian role of saying, okay, well, everyone's playing and drafting players who are designed to defend the pass more than the run. So if we can build a team that can take advantage of the personnel, the natural weaknesses of that type of personnel in terms of a physical standpoint, you might have a winning formula. It's a little riskier. You look worse when you lose, and it makes you look more like an idiot when you do. But if you are right and you can execute, you have a big time advantage. And so when we look at, you know, when we look at this and we talk about old man game, you know, you've got Adrian Peterson, you've got Jordy Nelson. Let's talk about who has old man game right now in the league. Guys who, in addition to them, who will, you know, are starters right now, who, you know, kind of contrarian. And the obvious guys, a quarterback, they kind of are exceptions in terms of how people view them. People often look at quarterbacks and say, oh, they can still be effective after 35 and they're not too old to play. You know, we've seen that with Tom Brady, who's 40, Philip Rivers, who's 36. But let's talk about what makes them, you know, why they have old man game. And I think the first thing when you look at quarterbacks is that old man game, again, is conceptual and technical. So the things that they share, first and foremost, is how they read the defense. They understand coverages that they're facing. They understand pre and post snap reads. They know how to use motion, shifts, and dummy snap counts to bait defenders into tells late in the pre-snap process. think about it this way. Defenders in the NFL often reveal their intentions about 1 to 3 seconds before the snap. And that either confirms or contradicts what the quarterback is thinking when they first observed the formation or alignment. And then there's also another confirmation, contradiction kind of process that happens within a second after the snap. Think of it as maybe a safety who's facing the line of scrimmage in, you know, before the snap, and then late in the process, just before the snap is made, they turn their hips inside or outside or take a couple of steps forward or backward. That can often give a tell to the quarterback that the coverage is going to be different. Maybe now it's going to be more man, or instead of it being cover three, it's going to be cover two, or instead of it being cover one, it's going to be cover two. Or maybe a linebacker jumps in a direction based on a dummy snap count. And that's something that the quarterback did to try and reveal some sort of tell from the defense. The same thing happens when they motion and force a safety or a linebacker or a corner or all three to even react. And that confirms or contradicts a coverage that the quarterback's expecting before that shift. And that's what those guys do extremely well. The best quarterbacks understand how to get tells from the defense. And the younger quarterbacks are the ones that oftentimes miss those types of tells. You know, they go through the motions sometimes doing some of these things, but they don't always see it as clearly, or they don't know when or how to use it in a way so that they can truly get a strong tell, as opposed to doing it so much that defense becomes used to them trying to fish for something and they become more disciplined. So, you know, those are some things that you want to look at. Another is anticipation and placement. You know, understanding where the ball needs to be. Phillip Rivers has terrific anticipation and placement as well, in terms of boundary throws or, you know, 50-50 throws. And that's something that he's always had, this kind of old man game. And in fact, you could say that Phillip Rivers came into the league physically looking like a 36-year-old guy. He never had that top-notch athletic ability. He was not a guy that's going to break the pocket and get 20, 30-yard gains. He wasn't someone that was going to break multiple tackles and be quicker than everybody else. But he could anticipate also in the pocket when to move. He had terrific pocket maneuverability. He understood where the routes were breaking and knew where the ball needed to be placed before the receiver was even remotely there. You can even hear on the top 100, you know, on NFL Network, where Keenan Allen is talking about Rivers throwing him a ball on a corner route, and he thought, I'm never going to reach that throw because the ball was let go so early. But he kept running, and it was exactly where it needed to be in the back corner of the end zone with him in tight cover, you know, dealing with a man in tight coverage, and he was able to make the catch. That's anticipation as well as placement. You know, other things, and, you know, I talked about pocket maneuverability. Tom Brady's great at that. You know, he knows how to knows when to take 2 to 3 steps to avoid a defender. He can see the defender from 5 or 6 yards away and know that he's got to react early, or he knows when he has to wait until the defender's within a step of him and make the slightest movement. This is maturity. This is judgment. It's understanding patterns and seeing those patterns and knowing how to react to them. And that takes experience oftentimes, or it takes just a vital understanding of reading patterns with defenders and having the right types of practice or the right types of exposure. And some younger players have some of these skills already in their bag, but as they get older, they develop more of them if they continue to have success and be able to stay on the field. Running backs who have it, you know, we talked about Adrian Peterson, and Marshawn Lynch to agree, but Frank Gore is obviously you know, the definition of old man game right now at age 34. I mean, this is a guy that last year, if you watched him with the Colts, a lot of people say he was done because they look at his efficiency. But if you look at the plays that they ran, Frank Gore versus, say, a guy like Marlon Mack is a superior athlete to Frank Gore right now. He's faster. He's quicker. He's probably, you know, has a quicker change of direction speed in terms of, if you're just going to measure him at like combine type metric exercises, physical metrics. But when you look at reacting to the defense, understanding blocking schemes, knowing how to press and cut back, knowing when to press and cut back, knowing when to, you know, what defender to read and what the keys are and how deep you should go to press the line of scrimmage. Frank Gore was 10 times better than Marlon Mack last year at this. I've got tape that I showed on Twitter and on my Instagram account, Matt Waldman RSP, where I showed Frank Gore and Marlon Mack on a Thursday night against the Broncos. I think it was a Thursday night game where they run the same exact play and Mack does not know how to press it at all. Gore presses expertly and gets a lot more yardage and gets a first down on the play. And there were multiple plays, you know, during the season where you could see that Mack just didn't understand how to follow blocks, how to set up defenders. And Frank Gore is practically a living teaching tape for these types of things. And here he is going to the Miami Dolphins, and people will say, well, he's playing for his hometown team, and that's all great. But, you know, Kenyon Drake is going to be the man. And Kenyon Drake played very well last year. But I was never really high on Kenyon Drake coming out from the draft. I felt like he needed some time to develop. But the good thing was is that when you look at where Drake is developing, he's developing in a gap-oriented scheme. And that's the best scheme for a back of his lack of refinement, because in gap-oriented schemes, you are really encouraged to hit a crease hard, hit it immediately, not much manipulation needed at all. You're not trying to press and cut back all that often. You're just trying to identify one crease and get through it as quickly as you can and use that strength, speed, and power. And certainly Kenyon Drake has all of that. And behind a young offensive line that has some talent, that was using the gap scheme, he had some really big plays. He also had some issues on short yardage runs. He had some issues on, you know, on plays where he did have to press and cut back, or that he had to deal with penetration and how to be a little wiser. Frank Gore is going to come in and he's going to give Kenyon Drake an opportunity to learn. If Kenyon Drake can not only look at this as just a competition, but also a learning opportunity, he could become an infinitely better back within the span of a year, year and a half, working with Frank Gore. If he embraces the fact that Frank Gore could be there to be his teacher, it could be wonderful for that team and for Kenyon Drake, because Gore is going to be able to show him how to read keys, how he looks at the game, and Drake can learn to work at that. And I think that you're going to see, you know, even now, you know, the thing about Gore is that understanding of the scheme designs, pressing the lanes, but also the connection between setting up blocks and the physical use of your feet and legs and hips and pads to execute these, you know, conceptual skills, both planned and unplanned. And it's about sharp technique. When you can, you know, for a running back, it's about, you know, the crisp footwork, understanding how to run with your feet under your pads, understanding how to drop your hips so that you can come to sudden stops and change direction quickly. And Gore can still do all that. He still plays quick. He's still quick within, you know, 5 to 10 yards of the line of scrimmage. He still understands how to get his pads low so that he's playing with leverage. And you have to understand that leverage and footwork generate more broken tackles than just sheer strength. So you can be raw with sheer strength and break fewer tackles than a guy who may not be quite as strong but has great leverage and footwork. Ahmad Bradshaw broke a lot of tackles, and he was not a strong back, not compared to a lot of other guys who were wilder but really didn't understand how to play within their pads with their feet under them. And that's something that Kenyon Drake came into the league a much wilder back than a raw athlete. He was a raw athlete who carried the ball. He's developing into a good running back. Frank Gore is going to give him a graduate level course. And we're looking at wide receivers. Look at the same thing. Guys like Larry Fitzgerald and Jordy Nelson, they understand how to read zones. They have a rapport with their quarterback. They know when the openings are, where the openings are supposed to be based on the alignment, late pre-snap, an early post snap. They can find those tells, know what the quarterback's going to try and do and what route they need to run, and that the quarterback expects them to run that route. It's also about having the ability to read the way one-on-one defenders are going to play them and use the correct techniques to set up routes. And they gain separation with quickness, but that quickness is based on precise technique over just sheer speed and strength. Again, like the running backs, wide receivers and tight ends understand, you know, precision of technique creates quickness as good or better than sheer speed and raw athletic ability. And they know how to work back to a quarterback or to the open area on broken plays. They know how to improvise. They're thinking fast. They're reacting without hesitation because they've seen enough patterns based on, you know, game experience, based on film study, based on studying different defensive patterns and understanding coverages, so that when they see something change, they know where to go and they don't have to think about it. You know, players who fit that at the tight end position, you know, similar for tight end as it is receiver. Ben Watson, who's 37, you know, we knew Jason Witten before he's retired, was still having strong seasons. He's 35. You know, Delanie Walker at 33, Vernon Davis at 33, they're still good athletes. They haven't dropped off much at all. But Ben Watson at 37, I mean, listen, last year he led all Ravens tight ends coming off an Achilles tear. And at 35 years of age, I believe it was 35, he had a Pro Bowl season at either 34 or 35 with the Saints. So don't be surprised if Watson and Breeze have a strong season this year, as long as the old man game doesn't deteriorate in terms of, you know, him getting hurt. You know, when we talk about players who may have old man elements of old man game, who, you know, are younger players, Nick Chubb, his understanding of leverage, his understanding of skills in terms of pad level, reading blocking schemes, both gap and zone, are extremely strong. He has elements of old man game. I think Darius Geis as a runner between the tackles certainly has that too. He's a guy that I would certainly look at and say that he has those elements. Dante Pettis has a little old man game because he understands really how to set up routes. He's got that skill to really work defenders at a level where it's not just about, you know, how fast or how strong he is, but how to win with leverage. He's a very good example of that kind of old man game. Deshaun Hamilton and Byron Pringle have certain elements in terms of being able to separate from the line of scrimmage and set up breaks with that kind of old man game. So those are guys that, you know, certainly whether you're young or old, it's again about understanding that conceptual and technical skill are just as important as physical skill, and that they can oftentimes become areas that help you compensate for a loss of that physical prowess that you may have had in your youth. And so I would just say to you that as you're scouting players or looking at options this summer and evaluating how players are, because part of scouting isn't just evaluating rookie talent, but it's also about evaluating existing NFL talent. Are they good enough to continue to play in the league? Are they a good fit for your team? Are they someone that can contribute right now? If we have a major injury to a star player, can we sign this guy off the street and him provide a high level of play for us that will help us continue to be contenders? And you have to look at players like this who are older in their 30s, or if you're signing a free agent, can they be helpful not only in the locker room to teach the younger players and be a second coach on the field or make the transition easy with a quarterback in the way that maybe Jordy Nelson would with Derek Carr, because of the fact that he's so conceptually sound and experienced that he can be an extra coach on the field almost, and really accelerate Derek Carr's game as well as the games of Amari Cooper and Martavis Bryant. But can he also play? And I think the answer is that when you look at guys like this, the answer is yes. And, you know, oftentimes, again, we want to be a little bit more nuanced when we do analysis of of football talent. And I think that we can become guilty of kind of throwing the baby out with the bathwater when there's a bad season with supporting staff and pinning it to a player because we see the age number. And maybe the percentages of them actually succeeding on in a statistical manner are lower because they're older and it has to do with the financial aspects. You know, it's more financially motivated sometimes in terms of how much a team really wants to use that player or invest in that player more than it is in that a player's ability to actually play another year or two. So thanks again for listening. You can check out more of the RSP casts at my blog, www.mattwaldmanrsp.com. I am coming to iTunes and Google Play pretty soon. Should be up and have a feed within the next couple of weeks, if not sooner. You can also check out my YouTube channel, the RSP Film Room, for a lot of video analysis on players. Follow me at Twitter, at Matt Waldman. Thanks again.